head to Hebrews. We're going to finish our study tonight in chapter 4, and with our focus on the final verse of the chapter, verse 16. We've spent quite a bit of time now in chapter 4. In one sense, I'm sad to finish it, but happy that the study immediately ahead of us tonight is the focus that's highlighted here in verse 16. I can easily identify Hebrews 4:16 as one of my very, very, very most favorite verses in the entire Bible. I'd probably put it in my top 10 of all verses in terms of my personal favorites. And I hope it's one that you're well familiar with and is dear to your heart as it is to mine. As I'm teaching through this verse tonight, I actually hope that there's nothing that I'll teach you that is brand new to you. I hope that everything I cover you already understand and you already grasp at a heart level and you're already walking and benefiting from as an ongoing part of your relationship with the Lord. And in that case, our study tonight would be just a good, healthy review of things that we periodically need to be reminded of and refreshed in because they are so critically important to our life and our walk with the Lord that we need to hear these things and we need to hear them more, not less frequently. So let's then read not just verse 16, but let's read that last section of verses for tonight, verses 14 through 16. We've already covered 14 and 15 in our study, but we will read the entire group together. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. We've identified that these last three verses are how Paul, by the gracious inspiration of the Spirit of God, ends a long section starting early in chapter 3 and extending all the way to the end of verse 11, the end of verse 11 of chapter 4, which is a warning section. And it's strong. It's piercing. It's meant to reach down deep inside of the first reader's hearts and grab their heart's attention because they really need to be brought to attention because they're in a circumstance of spiritual danger and they're not even fully aware of how dangerous their situation is. Their danger, remember, is they're Jewish people, first century culture, they're under the pressure of what we call persecution that's being brought to bear on their lives. And that pressure of persecution is tempting some of them to pull back from their public confession and connection to Jesus as Messiah. Their mistaken belief is that if they simply publicly disconnect, publicly compromise from being so bold in proclaiming him as Messiah, that perhaps they can alleviate some of the persecution that's coming their way, that it'll be redirected toward others who are more boldly proclaiming that name and holding to that confession. The problem is, and we understand this from a biblical perspective throughout God's Word, there is no such thing as I can remain true to the Lord in my heart and in private and in a silent circumstance and publicly, publicly not draw that kind of attention to myself, and yet the Lord will treat me as if everything's just fine between us. So what was happening for these people is under this pressure, they were compromising. Some of them were. And so Paul warns them in this very sharp, direct word to their hearts, and having wounded them in the warning here at the end of chapter 4, he then binds up their wounds by a strong word of encouragement. And he ends this strong word of encouragement before he returns in chapter 5, verse 1, to more instruction about the nature and role of our heavenly high priest. He now directs their attention and us along with them to our heavenly high priest. And he identifies Jesus as our great high priest of the new covenant. He identifies that Jesus has left planet Earth. He has passed through, as we studied, heaven number one, the atmosphere around this planet. Heaven number two, the entire universe, the created universe as we know them. And he has passed into heaven number three, what Paul describes in one of his letters elsewhere as the third heaven, the actual location of God's throne, God's manifest presence. And he is now seated there in heaven. So the focus now is on Jesus as high priest in heaven. Now, he identifies that the nature of our high priest is that he's a sympathetic high priest. He knows what it's like to experience temptation, because we saw in our study last week that in every sense that a human being can be tempted, he was tempted. And yet in the fullness of his temptation experience, he never once crossed the line. He never once compromised. He never once sinned. He never once failed to walk in the fullness of holiness and righteousness in this world as a real human being, under the most intense pressure being brought to bear directly on him by Satan himself, in a way that even exceeded the pressure that these Hebrews were facing. And so because of that, Paul directs their attention to him to say he can sympathize with what you're going through, while at the same time having maintained his own sinless holiness. We identified that sinlessness that Paul refers to in the previous verse 15, who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. We identified that last week as one of the essentials of the Christian faith. The sinlessness of Christ forms the righteous foundation for the saving work of Christ, the redeeming work of Christ. Unless he had been sinless, his sacrifice on the cross would have had no saving benefit for us. His death would have been no greater than anyone else's death, even the best of men in human history. But because he was sinless, his death has a saving, redeeming, transforming benefit that we receive and we gain. Now, with that, let's move on to his last word of encouragement in verse 16 before he returns to instructing us about the nature of the high priesthood of Christ, starting in our next study in chapter 5, verse 1. So our focus tonight is on the last verse 16. Let us then, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. First thing I want to mention is simply that the phrase, let us then, translated in other translations as, therefore, let us draw near. The idea is everything he's about to say in verse 16 is really based on verses 14 through 16. So he wants us to keep in mind everything he's just instructed our hearts in concerning the high priesthood of Christ, as I just reminded us of. But with that perspective of the sympathetic nature of our great high priest, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace. Now, what we're dealing with here in this part of Paul's encouragement is the issue, and it's an important biblical issue, the issue of access to God. And I'm going to put in parentheses all the benefits that can be gained and experienced in relationship to having access to God. Now, there is a problem for us as Christians that I think we need to be regularly reminded of. And that is a possibility, anyway, of reaching a kind of state of presumption in our relationship with the Lord. What I mean by that is simply, we have been given in our experience of salvation so much in our relationship to the Lord. And we experience that so much having been given to us, not just once at the beginning of our walk with the Lord, when the day we were first born again, the day we were first saved, but this package of great spiritual benefits that we gained in salvation has been so much a part of our life experience since the moment of our salvation that the further you go into salvation, you should be, I should be, we all should be more and more aware of what we have been blessed with. But it's so easy the further into our salvation to begin to presume on what we've been given as though, in a sense, it belongs to us in the perspective of we've somehow earned this, we somehow deserve this, and oftentimes I don't even bother to think about it because I just daily enjoy all of these benefits. And so I think what Paul is doing here at this point is he is wanting to, in a sense, stop as we're following him in his instruction. He wants us to stop and he wants us to consider the glory of what we have been given in access to God and all of the benefits that come to that relationship, along with that relationship with him. Now, what he's doing here, as we saw in the last couple of verses, is he has returned to comparing, and this is going to develop this concept of access. He is comparing the high priesthood of the, let me put this first, of the old covenant with the high priesthood of the new covenant. Okay, so we know the high priest of the old covenant, the first one, we've talked about this many times already, the very first high priest of the old covenant was Aaron. And this goes all the way back to the days of Moses. He was the brother of Moses, but he was appointed by the Lord to be the very first high priest of the old covenant. This was not a man-made role in the economy of the Old Testament religion, what we call Old Testament Judaism. This was not a group of leaders getting together and deciding, you know what, we need to come up with some special role so that the people will have a right understanding of their relationship with God. So let's invent a new role and we'll call it the high priest. Somewhat like, for instance, later happened in New Testament history when what we now identify as the Roman Catholic Church and the leaders that became the Roman Catholic Church all gathered together in a religious back room somewhere in Rome, and they decided we are going to form a new role and call it the Pope. And from that point forward in Roman Catholic history, that role was invented by men. This role, this high priest role, was not invented by men. It was God's idea. It was God's appointment. It was revealed through Moses for the sake and the benefit of his people. And Aaron was the first one, but he was only the first one. There were going to be many and have been throughout Old Testament history, starting from Aaron and the days of Moses, all the way until Paul was writing this letter down many, many, many generations. And he's writing this around 60-ish A.D., somewhere in the early 60s. And there is still, at that moment, a high priest that was alive, that supposedly was descended from Aaron and serving in the temple in Jerusalem at the time that Paul is writing this letter. Okay? So what Paul is doing in this section, and he's going to do this repeatedly throughout the letter, as we've been talking about, is he's comparing high priests of the two covenants. And Aaron represents all of the Old Covenant high priesthood. In the New Covenant, there is only a singular high priest. That singular high priest was appointed by God at the very beginning point of the Old Covenant. But the same high priest, instead of multiple descendants of one man, Aaron, each taking in turn their own place for the few years of their lifespan in this world, instead of that, the only high priest of the New Covenant is Jesus. And there are no descendants after him, so there's no broken line of descendants. There's just an unbroken line of him from the moment he was first formally appointed to the role of high priest at the beginning of the New Covenant, New Testament era. He has served in that role ever since then, still serves in that role today, and will forever serve in that role for our benefit as those who are part of the New Covenant. Now, the reason why he's comparing high priests in this section, like in the other sections of comparison, is he is helping these Hebrews who are wavering because of this persecution, and they are wavering in the sense of disconnecting from the new with an effort to move back toward the old. And they are, in essence, without realizing what they're doing, they are making their own comparison between the high priest. And they're essentially saying to themselves, yes, Jesus may be the New Covenant high priest, but Aaron wasn't so bad as a high priest. So I'm going to just disconnect from Jesus as a high priest, but I'll still have Aaron, or at least Aaron's descendant. I can still go to Aaron. I can still get my sins dealt with in the temple. I can still get my sins dealt with by the sacrifice of the Lamb on the Day of Atonement there in Jerusalem. And at least I will have provision. At least I will have someone to represent me before God. And so what Paul is doing in this section is he's once again demonstrating by this comparison between Aaron and Jesus, Old Covenant High Priest and New Covenant High Priest, the absolute superiority of Jesus in every respect to every element and every aspect of what God had provided for his people in the Old Testament. All of this is simply prefiguring as symbol to point forward to the fulfillment and the greater reality that was to come and be fulfilled in Christ. So there is, once Jesus comes onto the scene, there is no option to go back to Aaron. As we rehearsed last week, what's going to happen here, if they were to disconnect from Jesus and go back to the Aaronic high priesthood here in the early 60 AD time period, what are they going to have access to? They're going to have access to what God has truly provided in the Old Covenant high priesthood, but for less than 10 years. Because in some 10-year time period, less than that since this letter was written, you're going to have the events of 70 AD. And in those events, of course, as we've recently been studying, not just here, but also in our Sunday morning studies in Matthew, you're going to have the temple destroyed by the Roman armies. And you're going to have the high priest's life ended at that point. And there's not going to be any further descendant of Aaron that will extend beyond this point. The line of natural, physical, Levitical, Aaronic high priests ended permanently with the last high priest that was serving in the temple in 70 AD. And now, even if the Jewish people were to desire to install a new high priest in a newly rebuilt temple, as oftentimes you'll hear well-meaning but misguided Bible prophecy teachers say, that there's going to be a temple rebuilt in the city of Jerusalem. Even if that were to happen, it's not going to happen. That's my conclusion. But even if it were to happen, there's a rebuilt temple in the city of Jerusalem, you still need a priesthood to serve in that temple. You still need a high priest who must be, according to God's law, directly descended from Aaron. Now, what's the problem with that equation? The problem is the genealogical records that prove family descent were kept and preserved and safeguarded where in Old Covenant history? They were kept in the temple. It was the most safe and secure location. But when the temple was burned to the ground, all of those genealogical records were burned with them. It is no longer possible. There may still be descendants of Aaron alive today. Maybe. We don't know. His family line might have ended back then in 70 AD. What we do know is that no one can prove and know conclusively that they are actually related to Aaron. And therefore, there can be no future physical descendant of Aaron to serve as a high priest in an earthly temple. This is not tragic. This is God's design. Because he knows that if that were possible to happen, some of the people of God would be tempted to move backwards in that direction rather than recognizing that the only provision now for the high priesthood need of God's people is found in the person of Jesus, exclusively and permanently in the person of Jesus. There are no longer two high priests. There's only a singular high priest from that point forward. So he's comparing these priests, and here's how he's comparing them in this passage. Reading again, verse 16. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. All right, while the high priest is not directly named or identified or even described here in this verse, the story of the high priesthood is filling this particular verse. And not just pointing forward to Christ, pointing to the fulfillment in Christ, but in this continuing comparison kind of way. So let's talk about this comparison for a moment. First, let's identify Aaron and what Aaron represents. There's this, the descendant of Aaron, whoever he was at the time of the writing of the book of Hebrews, representing the old covenant high priesthood. First point, he was on earth in Jerusalem serving in the temple. Right? Everybody clear on that? So the high priest at the time of the writing of Hebrews was, there was still a high priest, a natural physical descendant of Levi, a descendant of Aaron, who was serving on earth in Jerusalem in the temple at the time of the writing of this letter. Okay? The question was, what kind of access did the people of God, Israel, the covenant people, what kind of access did they have to this high priest who served on earth in Jerusalem in the temple? Well, you would think, since he's there on earth, you would think that since he's there in Jerusalem and everyone knows where Jerusalem is, everyone knows where the temple is, everyone can just get up whenever they see fit to do so and walk up to the temple itself. So you would think that there was ready access to this high priest. The problem was, there was no access to this high priest. No ordinary person in Israel had access to just, if they decided to, walk into the temple. They could come to the temple precincts. They could come to the outer courts. But they could never enter the temple proper, the actual structure of the temple. Even the covenant people, like we would all be categorized if we were in old covenant times, as the ordinary people of the covenant, assuming we're not Levitical priests. And we could, all of us, go up to the temple. We could enter the outer courts. We could see the structure of the temple immediately in front of us. But if we were to dare to presume to try to enter into the structure through the doorway to the temple, what would happen? The temple guards, who were themselves Levitical priests, would stop us at the doorway. They would examine to determine whether or not we were of Levitical descent, had descended from the tribe of Levi. And if we were found to not be of that priestly tribe, And if we were not properly prepared, even if we were in that priestly tribe, we would face severe punishment from the temple guards for daring to violate the principles of access to this structure. So in terms of Old Covenant access, at first glance, the Old Covenant high priest seemed to be very accessible because he's physical. He's a real person. We know exactly where he is. He's in the city of Jerusalem. We know exactly in the city where he is. He's in the temple serving on a daily basis. And yet we could not dare to go directly to him and draw close to him. We would be stopped at the door. So how much access would we actually have to him? Zero. Now, he's appointed for our benefit if we're part of the covenant people. And it is true that he was called by the Lord to represent our concerns before the Lord, especially on that one special day, the Day of Atonement. But nevertheless, in terms of us approaching him in between that day, I just want 5 minutes with the high priest. That's all I need. I mean, I'm not asking a lot. I just need 5 minutes of face-to-face access to the high priest. And I'm just an ordinary citizen of Israel. I'm from one of the other tribes, not from the tribe of Levi. If I attempted to go and just get 5 minutes with him, I would never make it. His guards surrounding him would stop me. All right, so the access issue is a problem. Second, only he of all of Israel, and only he of the tribe of Levi, only he of the priests that were appointed from the tribe of Levi to serve, had access to the innermost room of the temple. And you've seen me draw this many times before, but I'll draw it once more real quick here. This is kind of a simplistic top-down diagram of the temple proper. Around this building, and this portion is actually much larger than what I can put on the board here. This is an outer court. So this OC is outer court, outside literally. And then here's the front door to the temple, and this room is the holy place. Here's a second barrier to separate the structure into two compartments. It's basically two-thirds size in the first room, one-third size in the last room. And you have here what was called the Holy of Holies. And in that Holy of Holies, there was one item of furniture and one item only. And we don't need to focus on all the other items of furniture in the holy place and in the outer court for this point. In the Holy of Holies, there was only one furnishing, and that was called the Ark. The Ark of the Covenant. It was this mysterious box that Steven Spielberg took and made into kind of a science fiction thing in the old first Indiana Jones movie, remember? But it wasn't just mysterious in the Indiana Jones movie, and it's not mysterious in exactly that way that was portrayed, but it was mysterious. This wooden box that was covered in gold, and it had a representation on either side of it of two angelic beings. And inside the box, you remember, there were three ordained items that were to be kept permanently inside that box. One was the staff that Aaron used for a very particular purpose in the Old Covenant. Two was a jar filled with the manna that sustained the lives of the children of Israel in their journey through the wilderness. And three, and actually this is the first and most important item in the box, was the two tablets of stone containing what we call the Ten Commandments, the written representation of God's law. Okay? So all of that is contained within this box, and then there's a lid on top of the box. We've talked about this many times before. Now, in terms of access, what's being focused on in Hebrews 4:16 is not just access to the high priest himself, but also access to the focal point in the temple structure and the business of the temple to the innermost room in the temple. Because as Paul writes in verse 16, he says, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace. He's talking about drawing near to the high priest, but drawing near to the high priest where he does his most important business. It's not the only thing that the high priest did in the temple. For instance, one of the things he did, there's over here a lampstand with seven branches and seven lamps on it. And the high priest was to trim the wicks of the lamps and refill them with the oil that was burned. That's what he did on a daily basis. But once a year, he came, and only the high priest was ever allowed to do this. He came through the front door of the temple. He came through the second barrier, which is this great curtain that was separating the two rooms of the temple. And he entered before the Ark of the Covenant. And he did so in a particular way. This one day of the year was called the Day of Atonement. And how was he to enter this curtain and stand before this box? He literally was to go through the curtain, and only he could go through it. No one was allowed to come with him. And he was to stand before this box, which represented spiritually the throne of God in heaven. And as he's standing before the box, he has something with him, and he's to do something with that box. You remember what he had with him? He had a bowl, a silver bowl. Silver pointing symbolically in the Old Testament to redemption, to salvation. Because it's the price, it represents the price of salvation. So he has a silver bowl, and that bowl is filled with blood, freshly shed blood. It's the blood of the Lamb, the sinless, perfect, I mean sinless in the sense of physically without flaw or defect Lamb that was sacrificed out here, outside the structure at the altar. So he was to carry that bowl filled with the Lamb's blood through the holy place. He was to carry it through the curtain into the Holy of Holies. Standing before the box, he's holding this bowl filled with the Lamb's blood. And he's holding something else. Yeah, a branch of a particular plant, a hyssop branch. There's a whole backstory as to why those details, but I don't want to get too far afield here. He was then to dip the branch of hyssop into the bowl of blood, and he was to sprinkle it on the lid of this box. He was to do that, I believe, seven times. And in sprinkling the blood on the lid of this box, he then was to turn around and exit from that Holy of Holies, going through the holy place, coming out the front entrance. And on the Day of Atonement, all the faithful were gathered around to wait anxiously and to watch to find out whether the sacrifice that had been offered that year was accepted by the Lord. How would they figure out whether the sacrifice that was offered had been actually accepted by the Lord? How would they know? He actually came back out alive. If he was not accepted by the Lord, if the sacrifice was not accepted by the Lord, he would die in the Holy of Holies in the presence of the Lord. But when he came back out alive, it was a signification, and this is all pointing ultimately forward to the resurrection of Christ, but his coming back out alive is the confirmation that the sacrifice has been offered. But all of that was only to be done by one person, the high priest. Once a year, he's the only one that was ever allowed into this room. And even after coming out, it wasn't that, okay, once he's come out successfully and he sprinkled it with blood, therefore the door's wide open, we can all go in and see what's going on in there. For the entire Old Covenant, anyone that dared to enter that room other than him and other than in that one special way, they would die. They would be subject to the full weight of what the law required for such a violation of God's house and God's holiness. So the point here in Hebrews 4:16 is not just discussing access to the high priest. It's discussing access to this room. This room was walled off. This room was separate from the people. This room was, have you ever been to a club where there was like a public access part of the club, and then there's a only for the really special people private access club? Like, I've been to a Laker game before, and in a sense, when you go to the Laker game, it's like being in a big club. The club is the fans of the Lakers. But there is a room in the Laker stadium that is only for the really special and important Laker fans. And if I walked up to that doorway, because there's guards at that door, if I walked up to that doorway and I said, hey, it's me, it's Tim. I'm a big Laker fan. I've loved the Lakers for years and years. Kobe's my favorite player. I'm a big, big Laker fan. Let me in. What do you think would happen? They'd say, move along. Move along. I would not be granted access to this private room, this special room. Now, I forget his last name. What's the famous Laker fan? Jack Nicholson. Jack Nicholson has courtside seats. You know, he pays, I don't know what it is, it's like something like $2,500 for every game to just sit courtside and watch the Lakers. And when the game ends, apparently he gets up from his seat and goes to that door. And as he's approaching the door, what do you think happens? They step aside. Right this way, Mr. Nicholson. So good to see you again. Is Jack a better person than me? I mean, he may be, but the point isn't how good I am versus how good he is. The point is access. The point is he is recognized. He has permission. He has full access to a private chamber, a private room that I will never have access to. I've never been in that room. I will die in this world without ever having visited that room. Okay, well, I'm just thankful because I can live without access to the private Laker club. You know, I'll survive that. But if I never had access to this room in God's house, this innermost room, this most holy room, the room where, as God revealed himself to his people, this is where God himself lived. The whole thing is called his house, but he sat symbolically, spiritually, directly on this box, because it represented his seat. This is where God is. And to say, here it is, here's the house of God, but you can never go see God. You can never get into a face-to-face connection with him. You can believe in him, but you must do so from a distance. You can appeal to him, but not directly. Only your representative can ever appeal to him for you. And that only once a year. And that only under these very extremely special circumstances. But you can never see God directly. You can never have access to him. That was the nature of the old covenant high priesthood. As wonderful as it was, and it was wonderful because it was God's appointment, it was God's way of approaching him. Nevertheless, Paul's point here is that what the comparison is between these two provisions in the old and the new, so that when we get later into the book of Hebrews and Paul is still arguing about the great superiority of the new covenant to the old, it should be sinking in to our hearts. We can only hope that it did sink into the first readers, the Hebrews that were struggling with wanting to go back to the old and to disconnect from the new, of your leaving behind and disconnecting from Jesus. Not just that you've changed the name of the high priest, but this high priest is superior in every possible way, because while in the old covenant, we could never enter that room. This is what Paul says now. Let us then, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace. He's not saying that Jesus drew near to this innermost room, and he drew near to this box that represents the throne of God, but none of us will ever be able to do so. What he's saying is, Jesus did draw near. Jesus did enter. He passed through the heavens. This room, as we saw, is representing heaven number one. Or excuse me, this outer room being heaven number one. This outer court. This inner court, this inner room, the holy place representing heaven number two. And he drew near to the Lord himself in what is represented here as heaven number three, the third heaven, the holy of holies, the location of the throne of God itself in heaven. Yes, Jesus drew near to all of that in his ascension back to heaven. But when he did, something drastically changed in our relationship to all of this. That radically changes the way things were from the old to the way things now are in the new. In the old, you and I would still be stopped way out at this door. But when Paul says, let us draw near, he's saying, let's enter this door. Let's walk the same pathway, spiritually speaking, that the high priest walked. Let's go through the room that you and I were never granted access to. And even just going through this room, we've already passed the guards who are at the front door. It's like an amazing thing. It would be like I've just successfully made it past that door into the inner club of the Laker club, and the guards are back behind me, and no one's stopping me, and no one's arresting me, no one's tackling me from behind. I've made it in. But then that's not enough. I come to this second curtain that not even the other priests were ever allowed to pass through. And he says, let us cross that barrier as well, and let us draw near to the not just the physical representation of God's throne on earth, the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem. Let us draw near to the actual real throne of God in heaven. So, let's just detail in all the ways in this passage Jesus is portrayed as being superior as a new covenant priest with a new covenant provision. Number one, the old covenant priest was on earth, in Jerusalem, in the temple. Where's Jesus? Heaven. Is that better or worse for us? It's better. Why is it better? It would be cool, wouldn't it, if Jesus was actually on earth right now in Jerusalem, and we could just all, if we saved our nickels and pennies, we could buy a plane ticket and go see him in Jerusalem. Wouldn't that be cool? Yes, but here's the problem. We'd have to save our nickels and our pennies. We'd have to actually save up. We'd have to go in a once-in-a-lifetime kind of visit to see him. The fact that he's in heaven means that he is accessible to us, not just in that one location, but wherever we are on planet Earth, at whatever moment in our life we need to gain access to him, we have been granted that access. So it's superior in every way that our high priest is not on Earth, not in Jerusalem, not in the temple. He is in the heavenly temple. And the way God has designed it is there is an access point to the heavenly temple from every spot on earth. Because the access is in the spirit now and not through physical proximity. Second, this high priest is much more approachable than the old covenant high priest. If I tried to get close face to face, even for just 5 minutes with the old covenant high priest, I'd be shot down every time. I would never gain face-to-face access with him. He's just too important. He doesn't have enough time to spend with everybody in Israel that would want to spend time with him. So he just shuts everybody down. This high priest has invited me into his presence. And he always has time for me. And he never says no to my desire to spend time with him. This priest is perfectly accessible. He wants me to seek Him out. He wants me to come face to face with Him. He invites me to do so. Not just invites, He calls me to do so. With never once throwing up a barrier between me and Him to say, yes, but, you know, you got to deal with this, you got to handle this, you got to get this act together, you got to fix this, and then maybe we'll talk about access. He is always accessible to me. Now, what happens if the Lord granted me access to Him one time? I mean, if this were all that I were to ever have, if He said to me, Tim, one time, I'm talking about the new covenant high priest, Jesus, if He said, one time, I will allow you to come directly into my presence, you and I will have some face-to-face time, and I will allow you to come and see me a second time as long as you live perfectly from the point of our first meeting forward to our next meeting. If you will do that, I'll see you a second time. And then the second time I see you, as long as you live perfectly from visit number two to visit number three, I'll see you a third time. And we will continue our relationship as long as you live perfectly from the point of our last meeting forward. What kind of access would I have? I'd be just as stuck because I've, in between every time I visit Him, I fall short. And you do as well. Though He saved me, though He's changed me, I'm still falling short of the standard of His holiness and His righteousness. So it's not just that He's accessible, He is condescendingly accessible. What we mean by that is, He's not, though He calls me to a life of greater righteousness and holiness, He does not require a life of perfect righteousness and holiness for me to qualify to come into His presence. Why is that? Because the life of perfect righteousness and holiness that establishes this relationship is His righteousness that He lived out in this earth, tempted in every way like we are, yet not once ever sinning. So as Paul describes here, let us then draw near, but he says, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne. What is my confidence in trying to gain access like? You know, it's like I was describing earlier about the Laker club. If I were to try to get in, let's just say one of you, like Sydney is a Laker fan like me. Let's say Sydney and I went to the game and he just had a wild idea and he said, come on, Tim, let's just try to get into the Laker club once. And I said, Sydney, we're not going to make it. He said, I don't care. Let's try. Let's just try. See what happens. The worst they could do is say no. So we go there and with the best of intentions, we try to gain access and we're going to both get shot down. We're not going to successfully make it into the club. The point here is that the Lord is conveying to us that the success of our access, not just once, not just twice or five times, but the success of our accessibility to Him is based 1,000% in His righteousness, in His holiness, and the sacrifice that He offered on our behalf in order to provide this access for us. Our access is rooted in the cross. It's based in the cross. And so that understanding, which needs to overshadow my whole perspective of approaching the Lord every time I approach Him, creates in me a confident approach. It would be like Sydney and I going to the game and then we run into Jack Nicholson at the game. And for whatever reason, he takes a liking to us. And he says, hey, why don't you guys come to the club with me after the game? Now, as we're approaching the same door that we got shot down at the last game, now Jack Nicholson is leading us up to the security guards. What kind of attitude are we going to have as we approach the door this time? Last time, they turned us around, kicked us in our rear, and threw us out by the seat of our pants. This time as we approach the door, we're kind of strutting as we approach the door because we have confidence, not confidence that we've changed, that we're any more likable by the guards than we were the first time we tried. We have confidence based entirely 100% in Jack, that he qualifies, even if we don't. And all we say when we get to the guards is, we're with him. And that's our pass through those security checks. And in this way, when we're approaching the throne of God, and we understand this, I hope you get this, the most important thing to understand about God's throne is it is a throne of judgment. It's a throne of judgment because the one sitting on it is perfectly holy and righteous. Perfectly holy and righteous. And so how can I have confidence approaching a throne of judgment where the one sitting on that throne is perfectly holy and righteous? And I'm so aware that I am anything but perfectly holy and righteous. How can I have confidence in that? If my confidence is based in me, in my goodness, in my earning my way in my own character and behavior, opening the door in front of me. But once I get fully that if it were just an issue of me standing before the throne of God's judgment based upon what I deserve, that I would be destroyed in his judgment, deservedly so, righteously so, God would be holy to judge me in that way. But the reason I have access to this throne has nothing to do with my deserving it. Nothing. Not one shred of a thing does it have to do with me deserving to be there. It has 100% to do with his deservedness. How deserving is Jesus? And that he, because of his perfectly holy life lived here in this world, and because of his perfect sacrifice offered for my benefit in his sacrifice on the cross, he has the right to invite anybody into the club that he wants to come with him. And that's it. That's the story of my access. I'm with Jesus, and he has invited me. He's bid me to come into the innermost room. And I can approach the guards. In this case, the guards are the angelic guardians around the throne. And I can approach the guards and I can expect with confidence, bold approach, I can expect to be granted full access to not just come into the outer periphery of the throne room and kind of hang out at the back row of the angels and the redeemed that are worshiping God. But in this scenario, in this picture of the throne, I'm granted in the throne room scenario to be able to come right up to the throne itself and stand right directly in the presence of God himself. And I'm allowed to do so without being judged for only one reason, because his son died for me on the cross. Now, because of his work, and this is going back, and we've rehearsed this many times, this is pictured in the Old Testament Day of Atonement events. When that high priest brought that bowl, that silver bowl filled with the lamb's blood, and when he went through that last curtain and stood before the box representing the throne of God, and he dipped that hyssop branch into the blood and he sprinkled it on the seat, which was a judgment seat. We've talked about how that judgment seat was instantly, as soon as the blood hit the seat, that judgment seat is transformed spiritually from a throne of judgment or a judgment seat to a throne of grace, as Paul describes it here. And in the old covenant terminology, that seat upon it is a mercy seat. This is all picturing what was in the box. The most important thing, remember, being the two tablets of the law, the Ten Commandments. The idea is, when the lid is lifted, then the people of God are exposed to the requirements of the law very directly. And they're held accountable for every law of God and how they have lived according to those laws. But with the lid on the box and the blood of the Lamb upon the lid, then the law only impacts the people of God through the filter of the blood on the mercy seat. So that we never, from that point of its being sprinkled forward, we never are held accountable to the full requirement of the law as we would have been without that blood. Now, in the Old Covenant, that filter of the blood had to be renewed on a yearly basis. Paul's going to emphasize this deeper into our study in the book of Hebrews in later chapters. But for us, this high priesthood, this high priest is superior in every way. Once his blood sprinkled the actual throne of God in heaven, in his return to heaven, in his ascension, and the full saving benefit of his sacrificial death on the cross was established as a confirmed fact of salvation at the throne of God in heaven, that throne is permanently for us a sprinkled throne. So that the throne of God isn't temporarily a throne of grace and the seat upon which God sits in heaven, temporarily a mercy seat. For us who are in covenant with God, for us who have gained the benefit of the saving death of Jesus on the cross, his throne is forever for us only a throne of grace and only a mercy seat. So that, and I have multiple upon multiple times fallen short of God's holy standards since the day of my salvation. But I have never, since the day of my salvation, lost access to his throne. He gave me access. But going back to the scenario I portrayed earlier, what would it be like if his standard was, I'll give you access once, but you better not blow it from here on out. You get one shot at the throne and one shot only, and you better hold true to that. But if you don't, it's going to revert back to a throne of judgment. We would all be just as sunk as we were before the first time he gave us access to his throne. His throne is forever, permanently, a throne of grace and a seat of mercy. Now, we know this, but let me just get this on the board to make sure we're clear on our terminology here. In verse 16, rereading it one more time, he says, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace. And we're drawing near not just to hang out, by the way, though there's nothing wrong with just hanging out with the Lord, especially if you're hanging out in the throne room of heaven. You know, if you can imagine that from a spiritual perspective, how awesome that access is and that experience would be. But we're called to draw near to the throne of grace for a purpose here in this verse, for a reason. We're to draw near to the throne of grace that, this word that, is what we call a purpose connector. Meaning it connects the activity of all the words that precede the word that with what is gained in real experience after the word that. So here's why we're called to draw near to the throne of grace. That we may receive mercy and find grace. So you've been given access to God's throne for these two purposes, to receive mercy and to find grace. The implication, it's a powerful implication, unless you draw near to the throne, you will never receive mercy. Unless you draw near to the throne, you will never find grace. The throne is the exclusive source of these two great benefits of our lives. You can't find these two special commodities, spiritual commodities, anywhere else. There's no other store that you can go to get needed mercy and to find the desperately required grace to cover your present life need. Only there at the throne will you find these things. But what are they? What are these two commodities? You know them. They're familiar terms. We use them all the time. But they're related. There's a kind of an overlap point between mercy and grace. We all understand mercy and grace belong together. But they're distinct. And they each play their own role in God's communication to us of the special blessing that we receive only from Him that we so desperately need. I'm going to just give you a rehearsal of a basic, simplified definition of these two terms. What is God's mercy? God's mercy is when He withholds from us what we deserve. Now, if you think highly of yourself, more highly than you ought to, and I say, God is withholding from you what you deserve, you might be tempted to be upset with God for withholding from you what you deserve. But if you rightly understand who God is and rightly understand who you are in relationship to Him, when I say to you, God withholds from you what you deserve, you will instantly move into, I am so grateful and thankful that He's withholding from me what I deserve. Because I understand, if I understand everything rightly, I understand that what I deserve is His justice, because that's what justice is. Justice is getting what you deserve. What we refer to in our culture is just desserts. It's what you've earned by your actions. And what we've earned by our actions is God's well-deserved punishment. God's mercy is withholding deserved punishment. And when we're talking about God's punishment in this context, it's not a light slap on the wrist kind of punishment. It's not a mild swat on the rear end kind of punishment. This punishment is what we call in our culture still the death penalty. And in spiritual terms, this death penalty lasts forever. The experience, the ramifications and experience of this death penalty, once it's actually executed, it goes on and on and on and on into eternity and throughout eternity. That's what you and I actually deserve. Mercy is God withholding that from us and all that goes along with that in terms of punishments and consequences for all of our previous wrong behaviors. Grace, on the other hand, is the gift of what is not deserved. What do we not deserve from God? Any good thing. Now, we don't have time tonight. If we started cataloging all the good things that God has ever done for us, or is currently doing for us, and will ever do for us, a right understanding of grace is recognizing that if I currently, or ever have, or ever will, experience any blessed gift from God of any good thing at all, it's because I did not deserve it. In fact, my actions disqualified me from ever receiving any good thing from Him. But because of His grace, and only because of His grace, He chose to give it to me anyway. He chose not to just give me a little bit. He chose to shower me, to overflow my cup, to overwhelm me. Someone said the word lavish, to lavish me with all the good things I truly need from him. That's the story of grace. So when Paul says this, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, we do so for this reason. And really what we're talking about here, this whole thing is an image, it's a word picture of prayer. I haven't really focused a lot of attention on prayer tonight in this study because I wanted us to catch the fullness of the word picture. But that's what he's really talking about. He's talking about spiritually going before the throne of God in order to receive needed mercy and grace. To receive from God the withholding of things that would be happening in my life that I deserve to have happen in my life, but I really don't want them to happen in my life. And to receive the gifts from him of what I don't deserve and I really am disqualified to ever receive, but he chooses to give them to me anyway, not because of my goodness, but because of the goodness of his son. And so every time I come to him, I'm coming before his throne, and I'm invited by him to come boldly, to come confidently, to come walking in as though I belong there, even though I didn't, but now because of Christ, I do. And when I come with the full, confident expectation that I'm going to get favors from him. He's going to do things for me, and he's going to withhold the doing of things that I should receive but won't, and I'm going to receive things that I don't deserve but I'll get. It's what we call, when we talk about salvation being the good news, that terminology is just so lightweight. It's true, it's good news, but it's so much more than just what we would call good news. It's awesome, almost unbelievable news of goodness. And that's what we're being invited to do every time we come before the throne of God. Now, one more detail I skipped over at the beginning. When Paul says, let us then with confidence draw near, the words draw near are the actual action that we're called to do. We're called to draw near the throne. We can't give ourselves mercy. We can't give ourselves grace. That's God's doing. That's out of our control. All we can do is present ourselves before his throne with trust and confidence in the one that sits on it. And with a hope and an expectation that we're going to receive grace and mercy. But our action is to draw near. This is the actual walking through the rooms of God's house to get into face to face with his throne and with the one sitting on the throne. And here, the verb tense that Paul uses to describe drawing near in action is what we call the present tense. And what that simply conveys in the Greek language, as Paul wrote it, is a continuing or a continuous action. A continuing or repeated action. The point is, he's saying, as you're living your life in this world, as you're walking with the Lord, he's calling to you on a regular basis. And his call is, come into my presence, draw near to my throne. Every time we respond to that call, we actually do draw near to the throne. What is the limit of number of times that we can draw near? It's a limitless amount. So there's no, okay, you've been granted 100 accesses. You're at 97. You better think carefully about how you use your last three accesses, because once you use those up, you're on your own, buddy. What an awesome thing that we're not just granted access, but we're called by the Lord to repeatedly draw near. When should we draw near? As the verse ends, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So how often should I draw near? If I'm wise, if I'm spiritually on my toes, if I'm smart, if I'm not arrogantly, proudly presumptuously filled with myself, thinking, I got this, Lord. I can handle the circumstances of my life without your help. If I'm not in that mode, if I'm recognizing how much I need his help, how often do I have access whenever I need it? It's just the most amazing news in the world. Whenever you need it, you can go directly past the guardians, directly in front of the throne of the one who controls the entire universe, as Hebrews started, upholding the entire universe with the word of his power. He's got everything under his immediate and direct control. And he says, come right in front of me, and I'm not going to kick you out. I want you to come in front of me, and I want you to ask me for grace and for mercy in your times of greatest need. And when you ask me for those things and come leaning not on your own goodness, but on the goodness of my Son, what do you think you will get? This is what you'll get. You're going to find grace, and you're going to receive mercy. You will never fail to turn around and walk back out of that throne room without receiving these two great benefits from the one who sits on the throne. And when he doles out these benefits, he doesn't do so in dribs and drabs. He doesn't give you just a little drop of mercy, just a little portion of grace. I don't want to give you too much grace. I don't want to spoil you. He gives you as much mercy as your sins require. And he gives you as much grace as your life circumstance requires. And as Paul is appealing to these struggling Hebrew Christians and saying, basically, here's your choice. You can try to gain access to Aaron and his descendant and see what he can do for you now. Or you can come boldly, confidently, before the very throne of God in heaven to your new covenant heavenly high priest, who is sympathetic with your life experience, yet he never fell short in the way that you always do. And when you come, what you're going to receive is mercy and grace from him. Those are your choices. That's what has been presented to them and us through them. And what will they receive? Not just the mercy and grace, and we'll end with this tonight, that we may receive mercy and grace and find grace to help in time of need. This word help, interesting word. I'm going to connect it to this prayer concept. Help in this circumstance equals answered prayer. It's not just that he says, come into my presence, I'll listen to you, but, you know, fat chance that I'll actually answer your prayers. Help is answered prayer. It's a word picture of the supporting cables that were used in the rigging of a ship. You know, you can have a mast and all the sails and stuff in a ship, but if you don't have all the supporting cables in place, everything's going to fall apart. The idea is that our life circumstances, you know, we require a support system to keep us afloat, to keep us on track, to keep us on course. And our ultimate support system is not found to the left. It's not found to the right. It's found here at the throne, and only here at the throne. And there is help available to us at any moment, at any point, from any location. Whenever you are aware of your time of need, we have access to the throne of grace. All right, we'll stop there tonight. Lord bless you as you consider his throne and your relationship to it.